Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and our favorite video games. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How you doing today, Matt?
I'm kind of surprised to find out that they brought Ghost Rider back again, and this time it's a horror comic.
I mean, there's like four different versions of Ghost Rider running around. Are you talking about the new Robbie Reyes one?
No, it's Johnny Blaze is the most recent one that I found. I didn't know if Robbie Reyes had one or not.
There's two concurrent Ghost Riders right now.
Well, I knew Robbie Reyes was Ghost Rider in the Avengers, but I meant the Ghost Rider comic is Johnny Blaze.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I don't mind that, whatever. If you want to have Johnny Blaze as the guy, that's fine. Doesn't have to be, Danny Ketch or whatever. But, or Reyes would have worked for him. But my thing about it is, it's just weird to me that they made a horror comic out of Ghost Rider. Not that you couldn't do that, but you can't do... A lot of modern horror is based on building up anticipation. It's that, the slow burn approach. If there is a character less suited to a slow burn approach, it's the guy whose head is on fire all the time.
I mean, to be fair, they did the same thing with the Immortal Hulk, but that's not why people are here.
Immortal Hulk has a much better writer.
It does. But the slow burn, the Hulk is generally not associated with slow burn.
Yeah, but he did it with other people. The Hulk wasn't dependent on it. The Hulk was still basically just the Hulk. And I realize this isn't what we talk about, but
I mean, we totally could. Folks, if you want us to do answer comic book lore questions, you can. We'll definitely answer that. Do you want to finish your thought before I give the solicitation for questions?
No, I think I don't have a lot more to talk about on the subject. I just think it's interesting.
So on that topic, if you do have questions for this podcast or any of our podcasts, if you want us to cover a specific video game or anything that's heavily story related or lore heavy, this could be comic books, this could be books, send them in to us. You can go ahead and send it to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Let us know what you want us to talk about. As a matter of fact, we've gotten several emails and contacts about Warhammer stuff, which I'm very happy about. Just as almost as happy as Matt gets when you send us Diablo questions. If you are a Patreon supporter, you can go ahead and send those in to our Discord channel, which is Patreon Q and podcast questions. If you're not a Patreon supporter and you don't want to do the email thing, and instead you want to go ahead and do the Discord thing, we do have a Q and podcast questions channel. You can go ahead and throw them in there. Just specify what show it's for, and we'll take it from there. Otherwise, Matt and I are just going to fight over it, and it'll be interesting. So, but without further ado, we're going to start with our very first question. And this one comes from The Starhammer. Was there any lore behind Land's End Beach on the south end of Tanaris? The beach is filled with level 50 turtles, and they bite. I actually forgot this existed until you sent this in. Matt, do you remember if there's anything on there? I think that was wasn't it where the Bilgewater goblins?
There's a group of pirates down there in the Bilgewaters and stuff. Yeah, when you're doing the quests in Tanaris after the Cataclysm once, you get sent down there by both the gnome and the goblin that are in I can never remember the name. Gadget Zan. There's a gnome and a goblin in Gadget Zan. They're both working to try and expose the pirates. But at the same time, they're kind of antithetical to each other because one's obviously a member of a goblin cartel and the other is a gnome representing gnomish interests. I don't know if there's any lore to why this place exists aside from Tanaris is now much more water in it than it used to. A lot of the eastern side of Tanaris flooded. When the rocky side of it got caved in during the cataclysm. So there's a huge inlet, a bay that didn't used to be there. But as to whether or not there's a specific story about Land's Head Beach, I don't know of one, but that doesn't mean there isn't one. I don't know everything.
The only thing I remember from it, is I remember that there was, there's a bunch of turtles. There's also like, dune short crabs or whatever they're called over there. I do remember that there used to be a rare spawn over there. It was a goblin, like Frankie, something like that. And it, I guess it was supposed to be a place where the Bilgewater goblins crashed when they were heading to Gadget Zan, but they didn't realize that they had made it that close and apparently didn't have the means to make rafts or send word. So they just kind of went slowly nuts. Due to isolation and will attack literally both factions. So
yeah, there was, I can't remember his name, the troll, Rexar's friend.
Rexar and Zakan went there, didn't they?
Yeah, this was, I think it was in one of the books. I know that they went there and they found a bunch of crazy goblins who think they're cut off from the world. They think they're in like some lost island and they don't know they're on Tanaris and they're just trying to kill everybody. So, but again, I don't know, like you didn't used to even be able to go there. I remember in game, you couldn't get there without swimming all the way down. There was no other land-based way to get there. But the cataclysm, they created a passage. You didn't used to be there, but I don't know why. I don't think there's any other like lore or story involved with it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it just exists. Like, and this is, we've been asked about it a couple times, but I think that's really all there is to it. So I apologize. Like, we could go, there's been a lot of other like mysterious islands that have existed. This one just is kind of there. Maybe they'll do something with it later. Maybe they won't. Who knows? We're going to go on to our next question though here. Hello, Lorewatch. I am by no means a lore master, but I probably know more than a typical WoW player. With the last expansion expanding the lore on the Scourge, and the next certain to expand on the dragons, a question has popped in my head. The Scourge were a threat to life on Azeroth, but I'm struggling to find lore on what the dragons did about them. I know the Red Dragons helped with the Wrathgate, but it seems the dragons were largely on the defense. They were under assault from the undead, and the undead dragons were raised from their corpses. Do you think the dragons didn't have the numbers to fight the Scourge and waited for the mortals to bolster their ranks? That is from, I'm just going to use your first name because you didn't provide one in the email. That is from Ryan. Besides being under assault, what were the dragons doing during that time frame?
Well, I mean, the problem they had was the dragons were fighting Malygos. If you remember the Wrath of the Lich King storyline, one half was the Scourge and what they were up to, but the other was definitely how Malygos was pulling all the ley lines across the world and especially across Northrend to, I can't remember the name of that place that he, Kaldara, to the Nexus in Kaldara. And that's mainly what most of the dragon's time was spent doing. There's a quest, I know there's a quest in Dragonblight where you go to the Black Dragon Shrine and on behest of a black dragon to stop Arthas from turning them into ember worms. And there's other quests like the one you just mentioned, but it definitely felt like the dragons were like, we'd love to focus on this, but we have Malygos literally, you know, trying, he's sending dragons at Wormrest Temple. He's, you know, we kind of have to deal with that first. So that was, their attention was mostly on that up until Alexstrasza finally gets you to go in there and stop Malygos once and for all. And after that, honestly, I don't recall if the dragons took any more direct a part.
But
like, I don't think they did.
I think the question here though isn't during Wrath, because we kind of know what they were doing during Wrath. We were working with them, and we have the stories about that. I think before Wrath is the question, because there's this big period of time and it's not really addressed what the dragons were doing. I guess we could probably make the assumption that the Red Flight was probably recovering from their time being dominated from the Horde. Because prior to Arthas and the Scourge 1.0, I guess I'll call it, not Wrath, Arthas's Scourge, but when he was succumbing to it originally, there really isn't talk about what the dragons were doing during that time frame that I can really remember. But I would think that at least the Red Dragon Flight was recovering, right?
Well, you just pointed out the book Night of the Dragon, you know, the book Day of the Dragon basically takes place between Warcrafts 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
In Warcraft 3, there is no sign of what the dragons are doing. I don't think they show up like at all. I don't recall any real major or even minor appearances of any of the dragon flights during Warcraft 3. I'm not sure why. You could argue part of the reason is that, you know, they didn't know anything about it because Arthas killed Saffron, who would have been the one to warn them, oh, hey, these Scourge things are coming after our, you know, magic and our treasures and so forth. Saffron didn't have anybody to warn in the first place because at that point, Malygos was still cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. And that's to remember. Before Malygos turns on the Dragonflight, he's insane. He's muttering, he's ranting, he's mourning the near total destruction of his flight. He's useless. He's off the board. You mentioned Alexstrasza already. Ysera was asleep. Like, Ysera was straight up asleep. She was not awake. Arrhenicus.
Well, she was already fighting like the early vestiges of the nightmare at that point, wasn't she?
I don't know if that's the case or not. I mean, maybe. But we know that she was not on the board and Arrhenicus was getting into trouble. Like, we find out in World of Warcraft that Arrhenicus is trapped inside the Sunken Temple. So her consort wasn't there either. So her flight's totally leaderless. Blue flight's gone. Red flight's occupied. Black flight's evil. And probably took the opportunity to do things like, you know, get Nefarian and Onyxia into positions of power. We don't know what Deathwing was doing with his time. I think he was, we know vaguely what he was doing with his time, but we don't know specifically if he was ever like, oh, hey, there's undead things are a problem. We should take care of those. I don't think he saw it as his issue. And the Bronze Flight doesn't come out unless they really have to. Like, we saw, if you go back and look at the War of the Scepter, the War of the Shifting Sands, the Karaji didn't just have to be driving everybody out of Silithus. They didn't have to just cross Un'Goro and get around the Titan stuff. They then had to actually attack the Caverns of Time before the Bronzes would come out. Until then, they were, like, not interested.
Well, they're also kind of tunnel visioning on their role, yeah, right? Like, they were focusing on what they were supposed to do and nothing else.
But if you look at all that, what you basically have here is nobody's going to make the first move. Mm-hmm. Alexstrasza certainly would like to, but as you pointed out,
yeah,
her flight was in tatters. Malygos is flat out barely holding on to his sanity. And he just got, keep in mind too, what happened in Day of the Dragon was they all just got the rest of their power back for the first time in thousands of years. They'd all been going on about half strength for thousands of years. After the dragon soul got made. And it wasn't until Ronan cut the thing with Deathwing's scale that their power was released to them.
Yep.
So for thousands and thousands of years, they were going on half strength. Now suddenly, boom, surge of power. They all had to deal with that. Malygos, it certainly wouldn't have helped any. Ysera, again, unconscious. Don't know if she was dealing with the nightmare or not, but she certainly wasn't out and about. Arrhenicus was gone, so her chosen leader for their people when she wasn't there wasn't doing his job because he was stuck in Sunken Temple.
And technically during Warcraft 3 too, and this is something that I'm just now thinking about, if you were to take the encounters in the storyline when you're playing through the Scourge storyline, because there is a Scourge storyline in the Frozen Throne and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you're doing that, one of the things that you're doing when you summon Frostworms is you are literally sending cultists to find burial places of dragons to resurrect them as Frostworms. That is mm-hmm. what you're doing.
That's how Saffron got made into what yep. he was. That's Arthas did that.
Cindergosa.
So it's interesting. Well, Cindergosa was later, but in terms of what we're talking about, basically what it seems with the most plausible, although certainly not necessarily the case option, is that they simply had not heard about them yet. And keep in mind that it may seem like, but they were rampaging for 4 years by the time World of Warcraft came along.
4 years is nothing to a dragon.
Yeah, 4 years. Okay. Oh, you say Saffron's dead. Well, I wasn't aware he was still alive. Like, you know, it's not like they're keeping much contact. I don't think they were necessarily waiting for us. They were just being dragons, doing their own stuff. And when confronted with the Scourge, certainly reacting to it, that's not what they want to see. Nobody wants to see a whole bunch of walking corpses in the Ruby Dragon Shrine, but...
Oh, yeah, and for certain, like, I would think that the two dragon flights, had they been not one gone to the dark side and the other one completely diminished from years of being held in captivity, you know, the reds and the black dragons would probably have reacted very quickly to the unnatural disturbance of the Scourge rampaging across the world. But again, at this point, the black dragon flight is decimated and gone. What's left is fallen to the sway of old gods or is an outland at this point. Rathian hasn't been born yet. So none of that exists.
And Abyssian, technically Abyssian was alive, but he was on the broken shore dealing with the high mountain and not really looking past them.
And not even that, but afraid to leave the high mountain. Because he knew what was out there waiting for him. He knew the madness that consumed his father. So, like, he can't do anything about it. Like, he's still, like you said, he's dealing with the high mountain, but, like, also if he leaves that safety of those mountains, that range, then N'Zoth can reach out to him. N'Zoth can sort of get into his brain like he can all the black dragons, and except for, well, I shouldn't even say except, because he definitely hit Rathian. But with very rare exception, the Black Dragonflight was susceptible to it. They couldn't deal with anything. Alexstrasza was busy recovering and trying to figure out what was going on, what was happening with her own flight that had been devastated because she had been in captivity, being forced to, trigger warning, for folks with this particular breeding topic, but it was forced breeding. For the Horde to have their dragon riders, which is also in the Warcraft games, by the way, the Warcraft 2 and 3, a little bit more in 2 than 3. Was just more or less mentioned, and they were treated as neutral spawners. But yeah, like, they had their own stuff to deal with. And then there's also the economy of scale for time for them. Like Matt pointed out, dragons don't think like mortals. They're fascinated by mortals, and we start as Dragonflight comes closer, and we'll hopefully be able to talk about this in the future, near future, a little bit more. You can see that they didn't quite understand mortals. They had a vague idea. They created cities or structures sort of in the vague image that mortals would, but it didn't have any of the accoutrement or anything like that. It was almost like, you ever see those old movies where, there's like the Western Shootout and there's like a street with all these buildings. But if you zoom out from that shot and you actually take a look at the soundstage, the buildings are just fronts. They're actually hollow. There's nothing inside of them. It's almost kind of like that feeling where it's like stage dressing. Not saying that that's completely what it is, but you get a feeling of that with them. So also they're like, oh, the humans are, maybe they heard about it. Maybe the humans are messing with magics that they shouldn't have. They know warlocks exist. They know magic exists. They know that the mortal races were harnessing magic. They've encountered it. They've witnessed it. You know, maybe they're doing stuff that they shouldn't, and they're getting their hand bit because they mess with forces above, beyond their control. Okay, well, maybe it's not much of a concern. Besides, I got other things to worry about, you know, and that's a thing. And then until, like Matt said, they comes beating down their door, or forcing them to act. Yeah, they're probably just not going to pay attention to it. So it's not that they weren't willing to deal with it. It's just that they had other things that were higher on their priority list for what dragons are. So, all right, but I'm going to move on to the next one, which also comes from a dear friend of ours, Tetsemi. I don't remember hearing about one for Shadowlands, but is there an object in game you can click on and see the video that plays after defeating raid bosses, like the statue in Dalaran? If there isn't, do you think there should be? They should bring this feature back and maybe expand it a bit with some audio voiceover pictures to explain the story thus far, for the players who don't raid. Tetsemi is referring to, I believe it was Wrath that did it the first time, right? There was the statue in the middle of Dalaran. that you could click on and it would replay the cinematic for the fall of the Lich King. And this way, if you weren't able to raid, if you couldn't get into a raid and see it yourself, if your realm, if anybody on the realm had done it, you could go ahead and watch it. I think they did that a couple other times too. I think they did it. Did they do that in Pandaria? I can't remember.
They did one for, they did one in Cataclysm for Deathwing.
That's right.
I know you can go click on a big fragment of him in both Org and Stormwind, and it plays the last bit where, you know, they blow him up for good. I don't remember if there's one for Miss Pandaria, to be honest with you. I never bothered to go watch it, so I wouldn't know. I didn't go looking for one. I haven't really been paying attention to look for them since, so I don't know if there are any others.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. But it is something that I actually... It's not that I don't like them. I think they're an interesting touch. But I also think it's something where the fact that we have to say we don't know if it exists tells you all you need to know about the efficiency of it. Right? Like, if a player doesn't know it exists, how are they going to know to go click on it? There's nothing in-game that tells you to go, hey, by the way, X baddie is been defeated. We've erected a monument in the honor of the heroes that have, you know, defeated this villain. You know, why don't you go take a look at it? There's nothing that directs you to go do that. And Dalaran,
yeah, like the one in Dalaran, you absolutely did get a quest to go look at.
Yeah, and it's also impossible to miss too, because it's right out the portal room.
Yeah, but I think there was also one for Cataclysm. Like, there was also a quest saying, "Hey, you know, we put up a memorial to Deathwing's fall," and so, or something like that. So yeah, I don't think there's anyone. There might be. If so, they should publicize it more.
But instead, I would think, and this is more of a broader interpretation of the question, so apologies or not apologies, depending on how you feel about it. I still come back to this idea that I really like this concept of maybe leveraging lore walkers in the world. The lore walkers are this interesting, just, I didn't even want to call them a faction. They're this interesting body of individuals who potentially travel, and gather stories and record sort of the history of major events, and maybe not even major events, just the tradition and history of, in the particular case, the Pandarans, and as a result, everything that happened on Pandaria. But there's nothing that says now that the Mists are gone and the Pandarans have sort of integrated with both factions that there wouldn't potentially be lore walkers that travel the world. We actually know that there were ones that traveled before. I cannot, Chen Stormstout and Lili traveled. They were around. They've experienced stuff. Why couldn't there be other ones? And maybe you encounter them and they tell you the story of these major events that happen. And they do it instead of just playing through a cutscene, which, don't get me wrong, the cutscenes are absolutely phenomenal. And the cinematic team does a wonderful, wonderful retelling. But what if they did something in game? What if they did something that was similar to how the lore walkers present story, or how the Ardenweald, the theater there, actually like recreate some of your major story events from being at those key events from your memory? Do something that feels a little more interactive, and you got what I would be looking for. And I'm going to shut up now so Matt can talk.
Okay. I like pie.
Like, well,
if- no, I mean, I got an answer for it. Let me put it this way. I don't dislike the feature. I don't think it's bad to have a way for people to get to see raid fights and lore bits that they didn't get to see. Obviously, you're not going to get to see the fight, like, as in, like, playing it. But getting to see, like, the major cinematics. Because, I mean, I understand if Blizzard has decided it's not necessarily worth their time. Because, I mean, the second they put a cinematic in the game, somebody data mines it out and puts it all over YouTube anyway.
Yeah.
And I can imagine feeling discouraged if you're like, yeah, okay. It's not like anyone's, like... People are not going to even finish this fight before they've already seen this cinematic. Like, that's what happened with the Jailer. People had seen that cinematic. Like, people were asking me questions about it. And I was like, I haven't seen it yet. Like, you know, and if I hadn't seen it yet, it wasn't like a good chance that anybody else had, but you're already asking me questions. It's like, I don't even think the servers were up yet. So there's that's kind of a problem. And I'm not sure, like, if you are working on the game, I'm not sure if you can do anything about that. That's just the nature of the player base nowadays. But So I don't mind them having it in game. I think it's, you know, I liked the one, I really liked the Deathwing ones because they were fairly convenient. They were just right there in Stormwind and Orgrimmar. Mm-hmm. The Orgrimmar one was a little harder to find because it was up and over to the, like, way over in that, like
everything in Orgrimmar.
Yeah. Well, no, it was in that, like, in that place that was just kind of like put there for Cataclysm, which was not really, the one in Stormwind is right next to the castle. Like, you could see it from the palace, so it was pretty easy to get to. The one in Orgrimmar was in no place you'd ever heard of, you know, not near anything. It was kind of off the troll place, but nobody went to the troll place. It's not like the troll place was even a place trolls went. So I don't really know exactly what the answer here would be. I think one thing that would be better than constantly putting in, like, new monuments or so forth, if you wanted to use Joe's Lorewalker idea, or even the Time Walkers or whatever, or maybe combine them into, like, one group. I don't know. Like, we like lore. We like going, looking back at the past. That's lore, I guess. Okay, sure. Okay, want to look through a time window? Yes, we would like to look through a time window. But, like, imagine just having, like, you know, Lore Master Cho just show up in Orgrimmar and be like, did you guys hear about this amazing thing? And just tell you about the raid fight. Or even, like, I kind of miss those guys being in the raids. I know that didn't make any sense, but it was fun when Lorewalker Cho would just show up and be like, this is amazing. Like, imagine if he keeps doing it and you're like, Cho, how did you even get here? We're on.
Oh, Polis. I found this secret, the secret portal that put me right in here.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, just, and no matter what we do, like, we go to the Dragon Isles, we get to the Dragon Isles, Lorewalker Cho is already there. You're like, what? How? The dragon's just, oh, it's amazing. This dragon turtle brought me here. And just keep going with it. Like, every raid, every time a new raid comes out, Lorewalker Cho is already there trying, you know, dying to tell you about the secret. And maybe he even, like, work him into some of the quests. Like, he gets kidnapped and dragged into Castle Nathria and you have to get him out again. Like really make it a part of the game. And therefore, when at the end of the raid, if, you know, the guy gets killed on the server and everybody wants to see the fight, it makes sense that Cho's the one who tells everybody, because that's literally what he does.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to these things, watches them, and then comes out and tells everyone about it. So yeah, that's one idea I have off the top of my head. Another would just be, I think I'm going to stop there. The other idea I have is still kind of percolating and I want to think more about it. So yeah, I'm going to say, yeah, just let Lorewalker Cho tell everyone about it, or even have, like, this Lorewalker Cho, and I forget the name of that Torin Xanator. What was that his name?
I don't remember.
The weird immortal Torin that you met in Wrath of the Lich King. You know the one I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the one that was in the Time Walkers. Have the two of them, like, be the Starsky and Hutch of explaining raid fights to people after they've happened. I could be into that.
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of ways you can do it. Me personally, it's one of those things where I just want to see more interactive, or more, I hate to use the word immersive, but something other than just the cinematic, especially because the cinematics get pushed, like Matt said, so early and so prevalent everywhere. I'd like something that is contained specifically only in game. And that's a big ask. I understand that is, but yeah, if we're shooting for the moon, that's what I would go. All right. Anything to add to that before we move on to the next one?
I don't believe so. And I found the right button to push after a couple seconds of looking at my keyboard and going, oh God, which one's the
talk? It's been that kind of week, folks. All right. This one is actually a D&D question from Gavlin. Part of D&D's appeal is its established lore and multiverse. Fifth edition has provided source material for portions of this overall setting and hinted at even more. Can you provide something of a summary of the fifth edition D&D multiverse and its primary conflicts? The answer to this question is yes and no.
I'm going straight up with no.
Because, okay, there are, we can only talk about things that have already come out.
Well, no, not just that.
But, like, there's nothing.
They've said stuff about the multiverse that imply that it is every possible thing that could ever happen.
Yes.
It's every D&D setting you've ever heard of. It's to a certain degree, it is so massive and so full of we don't know what, that explaining it to you is practically impossible. If it exists in any D&D setting book, it could possibly be in what they're going to do. They've been bringing out stuff from, like, years ago. Witchlight had stuff from the D&D cartoon in it. It had stuff from the toy line, which didn't even appear in the cartoon.
Radiant Citadel's creating all new stuff, yep. Specifically.
Not just Radiant Citadel. The whole thing about the Ravenloft book mm-hmm. with the Domains of Dread. They then put out Witchlight, and now in Witchlight there's the Domains of Delight, which are brand new. No one's ever heard of them before.
And now the other thing to add in is now they're starting to branch off into non-traditional D&D settings. We already have a Theros book. We already have Strixhaven. These are places that never traditionally existed in Dungeons & Dragons. They existed in Magic the Gathering. Same with Ravnica. This didn't exist in D&D before, but these are now settings that exist. That's part of the lure of D&D in general. It's not necessarily that there's not an easy way to summarize it, because it depends on what you're looking for. If you want to,
another way to put it is this. The entire vast, complicated cosmology of Magic the Gathering is now a subset
yes.
of D&D. All that stuff exists as like part of the D&D multiverse. But what part is it? Where is it? The Planeswalkers and the Magic the Gathering storyline is very specific. And it has this very specific construction behind it. And now you find out that all that stuff exists within D&D, but not necessarily that the stuff they view, their cosmological worldview, might not be accurate, or at least mm-hmm. not accurate for all of it, just accurate for their part of it. And that's nuts. I mean, yeah, it's just, it is. I mean, sitting here trying to tell you all the conflicts. I mean, one of the things that if you read Fizbin's, one of the things they talk about is this first world concept. And the first world was this universal, this multiversal creation, this existence where everything was there at once, that until the war of the dragon gods essentially was this one unified reality. And as a result of that shattering of that realm, dragons today, when you meet a dragon, that dragon is a multiversal being.
Yep.
Like it exists, like you could kill that dragon in your universe and then go to another universe and meet that dragon again, and it would remember that you killed it.
Yep.
It's like, hey, I remember you. You were annoying. So yeah, there is a ton of stuff.
Yeah, like real quick, just to throw it out there, like over the years since 1977, there have been like a number of individual settings that are now all interlaced. You have Blackmoor, you have Dark Sun, Greyhawk, Mystara, Ravenloft, you have Lankmar, you have Karatur. You have everything that exists inside of Spelljammer, which was originally a way that they tried to bridge those ones to begin with. You have Hollowworld, you have Dark Sun, you have Alcadeem. Diablo 2 technically exists in the universe of planes that touch each other if you really want to get into it, because at one point the Diablo 2, I think it was like, I want to say it was like 1999, they actually released a tabletop book that tied into the greater universe of D&D as a whole.
They released two of them, three of them technically, because they released an AD&D one first.
Yep.
And then when they switched to third edition, they released two books for third edition. And I've got both of them right there on the shelf. So same I'm looking here. At them.
Then you have Eberron, you have Rogucon, you have the Warcraft universe. Technically, if you want to go back in time, had mechanisms to attach it to the Forgotten Realms. No joke. It legitimately was in print. How do you bridge Warcraft into Forgotten Realms? The Warcraft RPG book.
Yeah, no, he's right. Before the World of Warcraft RPG, there was the Warcraft RPG that was officially licensed and put out by Wizards of the Coast.
Yep.
Then they decided to do a different one that was not done by Wizards. But yeah, no, there's so much stuff.
And the difference is each of those settings has its own primary conflicts. Each of them has its own primary pantheons. Like in Dark Sun, one of the major conflicts is magic versus literally everything else, because magic is what poisoned the world and made it a barren desert. So people tend to not want to deal with it, and wizards are viewed as warlords, because that's really what they are. They have a tight grip on everything. But then you switch over to Greyhawk, and it's a lot more like it's the Silver Mountain versus the nine layers or seven layers of the Inferno, right? Like there's a lot more of a celestial conflict going on there, and the gods tend to walk the earth, and their folks, the people that worship them, whether it's monks or clerics, paladins, whatever the case is, and all flavors and all alignments are part of that ongoing conflict and war in Greyhawk. And you go to Forgotten Realms, which focuses more on the people and less on like the extra dimensional stuff. So it's Xanathar in, you know, his Skullport. It is the Blackstaff trying to combat that while being in Waterdeep. It's everything that's happening in Neverwinter after there was a major war up there that left the city completely devastated. It's a lot more about the people and the daily conflicts of life and survival, which is
Go ahead. I'm going to say this. Every one of these settings kind of has some bleed through because they are D&D worlds. While Joe's saying all this, I'm sitting here thinking, Mystara and the Weave,
yep,
the God War, the Fall of Baal and Bane. there's a lot of God stuff in the Forgotten Realms, but it's all of a piece. Basically, the D&D multiverse at the highest point of it is a metafictional concept that they developed to explain something that they've had for years, when that they have all this stuff out, and technically speaking, you can use any of it, even if it doesn't really, like, there's stuff, some of the stuff Joe's mentioned isn't even owned by wizards.
Yep.
And you'll never see a wizard.
But it's considered canon.
You'll never see it again, and they won't mention it. It won't be in any new books, but you can still pick up a copy of it and use it. It doesn't take very much. It's not hard to convert any D&D product, even one from like the 1970s. Like you could grab the original, you know, Keep on the Borderlands.
Yep.
It'll take you 10 minutes to convert it.
There's a company out there right now that does exactly that. Old School Essentials actually takes the old, basically the old book boxes that you used to get the adventures in, and converts them to modern readability. But not just modern readability, it gives you two different forms of it for AD&D, for those of you that want to go and play it as you would, or back then, with, you know, cleaned up rules that are easier to read. But it also gives you conversions for 5th edition. So you can play Keeping the Borderlands, you can play all of those with 5th edition, because now they're there. But like Dark Sun hasn't had a release for 5th edition, but it's still considered part of their backlog. Dragonlance as well.
And that's one of the things also I want to point out, is that a lot of this actually comes from the much maligned 4th edition.
Yes.
Because in 4th edition, they originally, going into 3rd edition and beyond, the cosmology was called the Great Wheel concept.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have the material plane, which was where all the physical stuff happened. And then there was all these other planes. And it was in this big wheel. And it's still kind of something I use from time to time, just because it's so ingrained. But what 4th edition did was they came up with their 1,000 points of light campaign setting, where it was fairly like you were living in a world that did not have overarching massive nations or empires. It had enclaves of civilization surrounded by threats, monsters, and all that. But their cosmology was essentially the material plane, and then the orbiting material plane was the Shadowfell and the Feywild. And they've brought that into 5th edition. And in the process of doing that, they had the elemental chaos, which is where the abyss was. That's where all the elementals lived. But then the abyss was like even deeper than that, where originally the primordials had reigned. And now the demons were, because they'd overthrown their makers, the Klipoth, who themselves had been, like, you know, just pure chaos. And there was just all this stuff that they put in to hold a kind of a lattice or a framework, and it's all kind of been incorporated into 5th edition. And as a result, 5th edition has a much wider net that they can have all this stuff happening and just accept that it's all D&D and not worry too much about it.
Now, that said, because I feel bad that we cannot really answer your question, I think in the spirit that you were asking it, what I would say is, if this is something that you're really looking for primers on, you'd have to be a little more specific, because the net that 5th edition casts is so wide now that it is virtually impossible to do anything of the sort unless you're getting very, very specific. So if you wanted to know like what's going on in the north, you could look at Rime of the Frostmaiden. A lot of that is in there. If you
By north, he's talking Faerûn.
Of Faerûn's north, yes. Yeah. Faerûn is the quote-unquote default setting.
Yeah, if you get a D&D book in 5th edition and it doesn't specify where it is, it's most likely in Faerûn. If it's not, like, for instance, Journeys to the Radiant Citadel is obviously set in the Radiant Citadel,
which is in the Ethereal Plane.
Yeah, but and like the Theros book is obviously set in Theros and so forth. But if it's just like a D&D book, or like he mentioned, unless it's the Saltmarsh book, which is set in Orth, The Greyhawk world.
Yep.
If it's otherwise, like the Storm King's, what is the name of that module? Storm King something?
You know the one I'm talking King's about, right? Storm
King's Thunder. Yeah, the Storm King's Thunder, that's set in Faerun. So right away, maybe that's what we should talk about. Maybe we should talk about the various worlds. How, like, how much time do we have for this? We can keep going, right?
I mean, we got 20 minutes left on this podcast.
Yeah, let me try and I'm going to try and set something up, and then Joe can expand off of it with some riffs when he wants to. Basically, here are the worlds you are most likely to hear about. Not all of them. These are not all the worlds that could be in D&D or have been in D&D in the past. But here's a good amount of ones that you're most likely going to hear about. First up is Faerun, the world that is the Forgotten Realms setting that's created by Ed Greenwood in the 80s to basically take over as the default D&D setting. It has traded places with the Greyhawk a few times. Right now, it is the default setting. Secondly is Oerth or Greyhawk. That's the one that was basically Gary Gygax's campaign world. That was the default throughout most of the 80s.
And third edition. Until,
yeah, and in third edition. And since the third edition, it has sort of, it's left its mark, but it hasn't been the default setting in a while now. After those two, there's the ones that I would consider still big, but slightly less central. There's Kryn, the world of Dragonlance, which is dominated by a war between two dragon gods, Takhesis and Paladin, who are now basically confirmed to be Tiamat and Bahamut under other names.
Correct, because Tiamat and Bahamut are multi-dimensional creatures or beings, like we talked about a little bit earlier.
Yeah, so they exist in multiple worlds. But that's the Dragonlance setting, you know, the dragons of Autumn Twilight and all that. More than we can really go into, but basically there's a war between these two dragon gods and the other gods that surround and serve them for the destiny of this world. So that's Kryn. There's Eberron, which is kind of like their steampunkish noir 1920s, but with magic setting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually really good. I like Eberron.
I like it a lot too.
It is one of those settings that it is kind of niche in that it does really good telling certain kinds of stories and like war stories and stories about like the continent after the war and what do we do and all that.
It was also very prominent during fourth edition, actually.
Absolutely, it was. It got its own book again in fourth edition. It is, however, a little harder to do standard fantasy with it, although not impossible because it is set up to incorporate it. But it just kind of has a more, like if you've ever seen a noir thriller type thing, it's kind of got that feel, or like a pulp adventure sort of thing. That's definitely part of Eberron's charm. Then there's the one I'm going to let Joe talk about, because while we both love it, I know he's done more with it in his life. Athys, the world of Dark Sun.
Dark Sun is it's a post-apocalyptic desert world, setting where, magic has poisoned everything, has basically caused the world to become a gigantic desert, very much almost like Mad Max style. Metal is incredibly rare. Most things are made out of stone or natural, like
volcanic glass.
Volcanic glass, hide, anything that they clay. Can get on. Clay, yep. And stonework stuff, where you are essentially competing for survival. And as it's not a traditional adventure in the vein of Forgotten Realms or the other Tolkien-esque style settings.
Here's a way to put it. If you thought of D&D as kind of like a computer role-playing game type thing, Dark Sun is their survival RPG. It's the one with a lot of survival mechanics. It's the one where it was so obsessed with this kind of thing that when the original version of Dark Sun, when it came out, you didn't create a character. You created a web of characters.
Because they would
die. It was likely they were going to die. So you needed to have other characters ready to go.
The other thing that I really use to sum it up is that it is one of the only games that came out during second edition that had a singular artistic directorial style. There's an artist called Gerald Brom, who some people may know as just as Brom, who is a gothic fantasy artist. I don't remember what their pronouns are, so I apologize. But they did most of the artwork and art direction for Dark Sun, and it has that very gothic horror fantasy feel to it, with very washed out colors and things like that. But it's all about survival. That is the key conflict. Survival in the face of magic, survival in the face of lack of resources, and survival in the face of cannibalistic halflings and elves, because that's the thing that exists in there as well.
Yeah. In addition to those, there are others. Joe mentioned Mystara before. Mystara actually is interesting because it is an example not of a campaign setting designed for play use, but one that just happened. Because when Dungeons & Dragons went from just having Dungeons & Dygons box sets, when Gary Gygax decided they were going to have advanced Dungeons & Dragons, they didn't want to lose the market of people who were playing the game they already had. A lot of people were playing D&D. Well, not a lot of people, but enough people were playing D&D. They didn't want to alienate those people with new, more complex rules. So they kept making what later on would be called the Mensa sets, or the BECMI, Basic Expert Companion Master Immortals sets, that covered from level 1 to level 36 and then beyond level 36 into actually becoming like a godlike being. And we don't have enough time for me to explain all this, but the world of the modules and stuff that was these games were set in, just by accident, when they made modules or adventures for this game, they named places in them and named cities and so forth, and they started getting reoccurring use, like as in the next module would come out and it would mention places from the previous module. Eventually a world took shape just from that. And so they had to sit down and like, okay, if all these different places exist, where are they? They're in this place. And they didn't name that world for 10 years. Like they, and not for lack of trying, they just couldn't come up with one. So they just called it the known world, or the D&D known world. And around this is at the same time as all those other worlds we've just been talking about were created. They were kind of directly created on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But Mystara just sort of happened. Like they just fell into being. Guy named Frank Mensa was the basic editorial guide to why it exists at all. And it's got its good sides and its bad sides. I'm a big fan of it, but at the same time, I understand why it's not really come back into popularity ever since, because it is a strange place that the rules conceptions of original box set Dungeons & Dragons were woven into the world. So stuff like only humans can get to level 36, or the fact that level 36 exists, or the fact that halflings are all rogues. There's no magic casting halflings or dwarves in the setting.
You can thank Tolkien for that one.
Yeah, but you end up with like all these weird things that they had to make work. And so I'm, but it exists, and it could, they own it. They could put out a new book for it anytime they wanted to. I don't think they will. Just like I do think Dark Sun will get a book. I do think Dark Sun will come out. It's too well known and mm-hmm. too distinctive to not get something, especially when they're talking about doing more stuff.
And especially with Spelljammer coming.
Spelljammer coming. And that's the other thing too. We didn't talk about Spelljammer. We didn't talk about Planescape, which I don't know if we're going to have Planescape anymore, because Sigil was part of a previous planar conception, but clearly places like Radiant Citadel are drawing upon Sigil.
And there might be Sigil inside of the Spelljammer space as well. We don't know yet.
Very, very possible. And it would be a good use for it.
And for those of you that maybe, if you're not aware, Sigil is the City of Doors. It is a city that exists. I want to say it was the Astral Sea.
No, it was an spire directly above what was then called the Plane of Concordant Opposition, later called the Outlands.
Yeah, so
basically the Plane of Neutrality, because that's another thing. Under the Great Wheel cosmology, every plane had an alignment, and the neutral plane was Concordant Opposition because it was the plane where everybody goes.
Yeah.
So yeah.
But I mean, it was where you went, and it had a connection to literally everywhere you wanted to go. So if you wanted to go to Athas for some reason, you could go and find a portal in Sigil to go to Athas.
Yeah, the portal might be any one of a number of things, and the key to open it might also be like, it could be like an old feather, or it could be the concept of drought. Like you could have to think really hard at the door about, you know, dying of thirst, and the door would open. Like, there's a reason we can't answer your question. Like, you'll notice we keep going off on tangents here. It's the nature of the game in this setting. So
yeah. All that to say, like, again, I apologize. Hopefully that gave you a little bit of an idea. And hopefully that didn't make it seem like it was that daunting to maybe get started or get some of the primers in it. But I think we're going to move on, because we have a couple other questions that I think we have time to get into.
I just want to say this. This is the kind of stuff that you don't need to know to play D&D at all.
Nope.
No, you. All you need to play D&D is as simple as, you know, everyone rolls a character and you just stuff them in a tavern if you want. Or, you know, hey, it can be a barn. Or, hey, you're out on the open road and a duck attacks you. Roll for initiative.
Or you wake up in a volcano.
Yeah, exactly. but my point is just don't be daunted by this. This is all stuff that is there for you if you want it. You don't ever have to have it. You could play your own game, never once worry about, like, you know, what's in other universes. Doesn't necessarily ever have to apply to you.
So we're going to move on to the next one, which is also a D&D question, but I think is also very interesting because of an email notification we received not too long ago. I'm coming out of Dungeon Master retirement to put together a small campaign for some new blood and a few vets who have managed to goad me into picking up the DM screen again. That said, I really want the setting to be in the Diablo universe, but I'm struggling with choosing a time period. So I ask you both, which would you choose? Feel free to run with the question. And this is from Zariel, the Lightbringer. And yes, that is a very clear D&D reference. I see you, Zariel. I see you. I'm going to let Matt take point on this one because he has stronger opinions about Diablo time periods than I do.
Well, I mean, I've thought about doing this. I never did. I always just ended up doing my own stuff. But if I were actually going to set a game in the Diablo universe, I think I would set it in the period that Diablo Immortal is in.
Really?
Yeah. And that's because there's a good, the fact that they put Diablo Immortal when they did is actually pretty smart because it's an established period of time that we don't know anything about. Like, we know that from this period, like, from the end of Diablo 2 to the beginning of Diablo 3, about 20 years passed, and we don't know much of what was happening. Obviously, stuff was getting worse all over the world. Demons were pouring out of the ruins of Mount Ariat. There was, you know, tumult in Chaldeum because, you know, the entire nation was destabilized by the fall of the Zakharum faith. There's Westmarch was having problems. Obviously, Kendaris did not have a king anymore. Its king was dead. Its prime, you know, its heir to the throne had a demon stuck in his forehead and he was going crazy. Then he turned into Diablo. So yeah, he was out. They didn't even know about the heir to their throne, and she never claimed it or sat on it or even mentioned it because she didn't even know that she was. So a lot of the world was like in a period of tumult, but we know that the nations of the place continued on. I don't, with Diablo 4 not out yet, I'm not sure how I would run a game in the period after Diablo 3, especially since with the actions of Malthiel, an untold amount of people died. So many people died that civilization has collapsed across the entire land. The land masses of Sanctuary are full of impromptu graveyards. People just dropped in the ground and died. And they knew it was angels doing it to them. At least some of them did. So I don't know what that world is going to look like when Diablo 4 comes along. And until Diablo 4 comes out and I get a chance to actually see the storyline and see the world, especially since it's going to be an open world, I would stay away from that because you don't want to spend a lot of time coming up with your campaign and then have this game come out and completely contradict everything you're doing. You know, that's something that's happened to me and I don't like it. but the other possibility, and if you want to go now, Joe, tell me and I'll just shut up.
Yeah, I was going to say, because we only have a few minutes left, I want to throw this out there and because I want to get your reaction to it. I would go for the time frame of Birthright when Aldissian was running around.
And I was just going to suggest that as my number two.
Yeah, that's my number one because it's the period of that time of where basically the Cathedral of Light and the Triune were in hostility with each other, basically waging a cold war. But it was mostly about the conflicts of humans at that time figuring out, you know, daily life. But it's a really cool period because you have that supernatural undertone that's right there that you could tap into. You know, it doesn't have to be overtly demons all the time everywhere, but it could be the church approaches one of the churches, whether it's the Cathedral of Light or the Triune, approaches the party. We have a task for you. We need you to go here and do this. And you start hinting and chipping away at it, especially if you're running with players that maybe don't understand that time period in Diablo. you can start slowly peeling back the layers of demons and angels of Diablo through sort of that lens of these regular adventurers caught up in a war between these two ideologies, essentially. I think that would be really, really fascinating because there's so much you can do in it, too, that has this sort of tinge of despair to it, mostly because you already know what's going to happen. So it doesn't really matter what they do, but it does at the same time. And I'm gonna let Matt talk a little bit about why he would pick that time. But I just like the idea of slowly peeling back the layers as they realize, oh, man, wait, what? We're working for demons? We're great evils? What's going on here? Why is that angel trying to sear my flesh off?
Yeah, like the Church of the Triune is very interesting because they were it was the three prime evils. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, Diablo, Mephisto, and Baal, but they were portrayed as spirits of love and valor and, you know, creation. They were like literally they were literally like the antithesis of what they actually are. So there was Dialon, spirit of determination, who's obviously Diablo. There was Baal, who was Bala, the spirit of creation. And there was Mephis, who's Mephisto, the spirit of love, which is like exactly the opposite of these guys. So it was really fascinating to how the Church of the Triune worked. But the reason I wanted to use them is honestly completely different from what Joe's talking about. The campaign Joe's talking about is very grounded and would certainly be cool. I could actually see it as a Blades in the Dark type game even.
Yep.
But the one I'm thinking about is just straight up exalted as the Nephilim come back. Like, as you know, Odysseus and his brother Mendine, and you know, these powerful, you know, again, like exalted, these powerful beings with like who can do things that are like unthinkably, like you can go fist fight a god and kill it. Like, well, it's not a god, it's a demon, but yeah, I can do that. Like that kind of stuff. By the end of the Sin War, Odysseus is doing stuff like just wiping the past 10 years out of history. He just resets the world stone and undoes his entire life, including himself. He never existed. He makes it so he never existed.
Except they mention him in Diablo 3, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, but that's the thing is the people are having visions of him because he used the world stone to do it. And when the world stone finally got destroyed, it unlocked what he relocks. The thing that Inarius set up in the first place, the thing that was breaking down during the Sin War, was the Worldstone locking Sanctuary away from its power. So, and from the power that was inherent to the various Nephilim. The thing about the Nephilim is the power that you have as a Nephilim is because you are a recreation of the power of the primordial Anu. The being that was both good and evil, the being that was everything, that tore itself in half and threw away half of itself. And every Nephilim has both halves of Anu in it. And that's where their terrifying power comes from. The end of Diablo 3, when Tyriel and Inarius are watching and you kill Malthiel, at the point when you kill him, Malthiel is wielding the powers of all of the evils, in addition to his own as a former archangel, and you kill him. Which means at this point, as Tyriel says, the forces of heaven and hell, he's a champion who can defeat the forces of heaven and hell, but within him beats a mortal heart. Like, that's the terrifying thing that I would play with, like with creating these characters at that period of time, because it's that they're more powerful ultimately than heaven or hell. And all humans have this. Mm-hmm. It's why Malthiel tried to kill us all. Oddly enough, it's also part of the story of Diablo Immortal, because in Diablo Immortal, like the demon in question, Skarn, wants to convert everyone on Sanctuary into a demon. He wants to, quote unquote, purify them, just like Malthiel did, except Malthiel wants to do it by killing them.
Now, there to move away from Diablo just a little bit, this is something that somebody emailed us. We get a lot of solicitation at the site for random Kickstarters and things like that. And it's hard sometimes to go through and see what's actually good, but we got a notification about an upcoming game coming out called Helgard Curse of Cana. If you are an old school tabletop RPG-er, it's got some pretty decent names behind it. Apparently it's being co-designed by Ed Greenwood, who is one of the original Forgotten Realms authors, and Gwendolyn Kestrel, who was one of the co-writers for the fourth edition rulebook.
And did a lot of stuff before that too.
And did a lot of stuff before that, but I'm just throwing those out there for like, they know what they're doing. But it's interesting because it's very much inspired by like Diablo and Castlevania from what we can see. And I don't have an advanced copy, neither does Matt. The campaign hasn't even gone live yet, but you're not alone in putting things in like a Diablo or Diablo-esque universe. And there might be resources coming out soon that might help you with it. It's just something to kind of keep an eye on in the near future. Just figured I'd throw that out there because I thought it was interesting timing.
Yeah, no, it is. I've looked at it enough to be interested by it. It definitely has some tropes that borrow from Diablo. But at the same time, the Castlevania stuff's there too.
Yes.
And it's funny because Castlevania and Diablo, you don't think have a lot in common, but they kind of actually do.
They're both giant dungeon crawls.
They have giant dungeon crawls. There's also that whole, you know, these primordial evil forces are just accepted in the various game worlds. Like, you know, oh, hey, there's that castle with Dracula in it came back. That's not good. Can someone go stop that? Like, really? Just Dracula? Yeah, oh, yeah. His death is in there, too. Death? Yeah. They're friends. Not sure what's going on with that. Anyway, could somebody get someone really good with a whip? Preferably one in this family, but we'll just take anybody with a whip at this point.
And that class already exists, by the way, in the core rulebook. There, the Urban Ranger is basically a Belmont. Just throwing that out there.
I always feel bad for Jonathan Morris, though, because he shows up with the whip and he's like, I can't use this thing. And they're all like, yeah, whatever, go whip some undead. But no, really, I'm not, you know. Yeah.
But I think that's going to do it for us today, unless there's anything else you want to add.
There is, but I don't have time. We do have to stop. So
yeah. But again, if you have questions for any of our podcasts, be sure to send them in. You can send them into podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Specify what show it's for if you want us to talk about lore on Lorewatch, about the story or settings for basically anything. If we know about it, we will talk about it. And if I don't know about it, I will go find a guest. I am absolutely A-okay doing that. Send them into there, or you can send them in one of our various Discord servers. As a few reminders, we do want to thank all of our supporters, because without you, this wouldn't be possible, because it is made possible due to your generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means this podcasting community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. We are starting to experiment with other tiers of rewards for Patreon as well. So you may want to pay attention to there. I don't want to announce anything concrete, but keep an eye on there and keep an eye on our Discord servers, as we will be notifying you when new things become available as rewards for those of you that continue to support us. And then one last reminder, all of us at Blizzard Watch continue to stand with the employees of Activision Blizzard, as well as the game industry at large, as they work to not only unionize, but just make sure that everybody is safe and has equity and quality, and, you know, doesn't hate going to work in the morning. I hear those are good things. So, but with that, folks, we'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.